Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Welcome to episode 6.
Which is actually episode 5.2.
It's actually episode 5.1. The surround sound edition. Actually, this is a very special podcast.
Again?
Because it's the second half to our super show.
That's why it's super.
Yeah. And the second half is The Last of Us. So for those that didn't tune in last week, I recommend going and listening to that podcast because I would say it was quite the doozy.
We covered all of The Walking Dead and all of Spec Ops The Line.
Spoilers everywhere. And so this week, spoiler warning, we're going to be ruining The Last of Us for anyone who hasn't played it.
Yeah!
And talking about why it is Dustin's favorite game of all time.
I don't remember ever saying that to you once. I said it was in the top 10 now. I don't know that it breached the number one spot.
Oh, it's in your number one spot.
Pretty sure I don't even have a good, witty Madden 16 or something.
Oh, mine's Superman 64.
Superman 64. Yeah. No, I was thinking, the E.T. game was about the funniest thing I could think of. That was buried and destroyed.
That joke is awfully troped.
Hey, we should do an episode on that.
Tropes?
That would get lots of views.
Tropes versus what?
Women. Oh. We abbreviate it, so it's talking about both. See, that's clever. We'll do that. That's coming up.
We do want to do... We have actually talked about doing a podcast about the tropes versus women videos.
And tropes versus men.
And tropes versus men.
Which are responses to tropes versus women.
That are...
of varying levels of offensiveness.
How there's not varying levels of
think any of them were ever done...
Seriously.
Well, maybe they were.
And now the word trope has evolved to mean something that, at least my perception is that people, due to the video, the trope versus women video, now think trope is a funny word.
Or a bad word.
Or that means a misuse of some pattern that, it's in a very negative connotation.
Yeah.
But
tropes can be okay.
Yeah, and there's things that are very obviously troped. I mean, most genres... are genres because they adhere to very specific tropes within them. But, anyways, I digress.
That'll be coming, I think. Because I'm sure there's going to be a week where we're like, darn, what should we talk about? Tropes versus women. There we go. Show done. Moving on.
Before we talk about The Last of Us, though,
it's time for Blake's favorite segment of the show.
It's time for my least favorite segment.
Of the three segments.
It's Dustin's favorite segment.
Why you gotta keep making everything my favorite thing?
It's time for...
Oh, God.
Is this a trope?
Oh, that's a new segment.
No, I'm joking. No.
That would be... We should do that as a segment.
We could talk about Riddick and how...
That's a movie that is a trope?
That's entire thing is a
trope. So then the entire segment is this a trope?
Yes.
Chronicles of Riddick. Yes.
Well, no, we saw Riddick, not Chronicles of...
Oh, no, you're
Riddick.
Right, you're right. That was... Whoa, it was... Didn't it have a subtext?
It was just Riddick.
Oh.
Which is really confusing, because I don't know. This was the only Riddick thing haven't played the games.
What a disappointment.
We haven't seen any other movies, so we decided...
No, I played the game. Wait, one of them.
Was it the same?
I played Escape from Butcher Bay for a while.
Was it good?
It was, it reminded me of a combination of, the Thief series... First person Splinter Cell, or was it third person? I don't even remember. I think it was first person. And I had something else too. Rogue Warrior, I guess.
The only thing that made me understand that movie was when you turned to me and said, "Imagine this is Vin Diesel's D&D character."
Van Diesel.
I thought his name was Van
Here's
Diesel.
Here's where we talk about how Blake doesn't know anything about pop culture except for video games.
No, the last movie I saw Vin Diesel in was The Nanny.
Wasn't that called something else?
Yeah, but it was Vin Diesel as a nanny, and it was pretty bad.
It was funny.
He's always a funny character, though, because...
He's very intense.
Yeah. But once you said that was his D&D character, I was like, oh, that's why the story
is... That's where the, like, whole him being able to see in the dark thing... Apparently he's, I think it's a Drell. Is that a race in D&D?
I think.
I believe that that is the race that he is, and, like, that is one of the powers, is they can see in the dark.
Because the story felt kind of like a D&D campaign, because... I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's good, like, campaign stories out there, but most D&D campaigns I've had, the story is very troped, so to speak.
That is what we're talking about in this, like, 5 seconds
here. Yeah. So, Riddick, would you recommend seeing it, Dustin?
I thought it was kind of... I don't know if I can actually recommend seeing it.
I can't recommend seeing it.
Maybe if you have seen the other ones and see their value and know what they're doing, I don't know.
You'd have to.
But for the viewers of this podcast, I'd say probably not.
Yeah, it was awfully...
It was, like, well-produced, though.
But it was pretty offensive, even. If you, like, there were just some parts in there that really, like, felt over... you heard a friend Matt in the background.
Matt, go downstairs.
It felt very, I guess, male dominance at parts. And I just think that it was way too, like, testosterone crazed. Like, it was like a 14-year-old's wet dream. So if you're a 14-year-old, you would love this movie, probably. Yeah, even though I don't think I would have as a 14-year-old. But
some of the violence was fine, and some of it was just seemed very, like, ultra-violence for ultra-violence's sake.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell, but it definitely did kind of tread over that line.
The sexuality definitely, like, just went...
Some weirdness.
Yeah.
Weirdness, yeah.
Really weird.
It was worth seeing, though.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean, as something to look at objectively.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's kind of like how they say the great ether of knowledge, that you learn the most about game design from playing bad games, because you can point out, like, what makes it a bad game.
Yeah, and, like, The Last of Us is, you know, just
Riddick does that. Riddick does that a lot, where you're like, this is a bad movie because of this. So, moving on to The Last of Us. Oh no, we haven't done what we've been playing.
I know, that's what I was, like, surprised.
What I've been playing...
Oh, going first this time. Stepping up.
Is, I think...
D&D? No, not D&D.
I've been playing Eclipse Phase, but that's an online RP I've been doing. That's been interesting. I can talk more about that on our role-playing episode.
Okay.
I just announced that.
Exclusive. We have an episode list that's about 4 times as long as our show will last.
And
we
don't know what the episode is. I've been playing Pokemon White 2 a lot lately.
Really? I didn't even notice.
Yeah.
I'm proud of you.
Yeah. I
think you're just playing it because X and Y are coming out.
Because Pokemon X and Y are coming out soon.
And you really want to play X and Y.
I really
want
to be White 2 before I play Pokemon Y. Especially since I'm getting a Pokemon Y 3DS XL.
I mean, I got a Fire Emblem 3DS, but I played the crap out of that game.
Yeah, so I'm really enjoying White 2, because I don't know, I think you really have to have played Pokemon as much as I have to understand it.
And how much have you played Pokemon, Blake?
I played through all of Red, Blue, Yellow multiple times. Yellow, I don't like. Gold, Silver, and Crystal, all of them multiple times. Ruby, Sapphire, Emerald, I played a lot of Emerald. I played Fire Red and Leaf Green. I played Diamond and Pearl, but I didn't play Platinum. That's when I started to die off a little bit. And then I played White, and now I'm playing through White 2. And I've played most of the spinoffs. At one point in time, I owned 32 different Pokemon games.
Including Pokemon Pinball?
Including Pokemon Pinball.
Pokemon Snap?
Pokemon Snap.
Hey You, Pikachu?
That one was weird because the voice control didn't work. That's one of the earliest games I can think of that tried to do voice... And it didn't work at all.
The commercials were pretty sweet, though.
Pikachu, go get that apple! But then if you would curse at Pikachu, he would be like, he'd be like, what the hell did you just say to me? It's pretty funny. So they put curse detection in there.
What else have you been playing, Blake?
Anyway, so the weird thing about Pokemon White 2, that, and well, I guess Black 2 and White 2 in general, is that they really change the sense of progression you get. In most of the Pokemon games, you follow this formula of a semi-balanced go to gym, use the roots or caves in order to level up your Pokemon, and then you get to the next area, and you're pretty strong. And then sometime along the way, in order to get you an extra level boost or whatever, we're gonna add some story conflict in there, like Team Rock, like all the different teams. In White 2, well, you also still do have that conflict of whatever team is wrecking havoc in the region, which they also, I think, really twisted it on its head a little bit in White. But in White 2, you get a lot more of these detours, and you get a lot more optional detours. Usually, if you've played a lot of the Pokemon games, you'll notice that almost any interaction with legendary Pokemon is saved until the end. It's endgame.
It's not always true.
No, I mean, you get...
Isn't in Diamond and Pearl, they show you the legendaries pretty early?
Couldn't get them? I think so, but in this...
Because they always talk about
But them. In this one, and this didn't happen in White, if I remember. In this one, not only do you... Because, like, in Crystal, you see Suicune fairly early on, but in White 2, I already caught, I think, what is a, like, this legendary fire bug creature thing. That evidently he, and it might not be legendary, but it appears to be, and they make it seem like a legendary encounter, but it's pretty early on. And then you also, which I don't know if this is considered legendary, but Zorua and Zoroark, I'm pretty sure the only way you can get them is through this one instance. They just give it to you. And so you're getting these more powerful Pokemon pretty early on. And then I also
pocket monsters, if you will.
So it's really...
To use the term correctly.
You'd be right if we were in Japan.
Sorry,
But we're speaking American.
Speaking American. American Spoken English. Like a true American.
So, it's... And I'm probably wrong, because I'm not as familiar with 5th generation as I am with the other four. I'm really best with the first three generations, but, I'm really enjoying it so far. I mean, I really liked White... Black and White in general, because they really deviated in that they... a lot from 4th generation. I wasn't a big fan of 4th generation, because every single Pokemon in the world up to a point was, like, unique. It was part of that set. They added 149 new Pokemon, which was the most substantial addition to it since, like, the originals, because it went 151, 251, 386... oh, they might have added more than one. I don't know how many they added, actually. But I know that they ended up at 649 from 493, which was a pretty significant addition still. More so than I think of any of the other generations. And I really liked the design. I mean, they got a lot of crap for having Trubbish, which was the garbage Pokemon.
That was a good pun.
But I think overall, like, it's just... 5th gen's really solid, and now that they've been with the second iteration through 5th gen, which is also really interesting, they've been introducing the way that they have the older Pokemon now, because they aren't being exclusively 5th gen for the opening area. It's actually really interesting. I think White 2 is probably
the best Pokemon out there.
It's got the best sense of progression. I mean, there are still some weird parts in terms of the overall plot and lore that they've never gone out of. Like, why are all the gym leaders weak? But, well, not all of them, but...
Brock is weak.
Brock's pretty weak. But they've definitely added a lot. And the other thing is the world is feeling more massive. So that's pretty cool as well. I'm really excited to see what they do with X and Y. I mean... They're changing up some of the rule set change now is kind of the Mega Evolutions, but I'm really interested to see, because the Black and White with 5th gen, they were deviating, but I think with the next generation, we're going to see them really deviate. I mean, besides Mega Evolutions, I think we're going to see a lot more interesting and different gameplay mechanics.
You might be able to capture the Pokemon now. Instead of just look at them.
Dustin's only ever played Digimon, so he doesn't know what it's
Liar.
Like.
Liar. I played Sapphire and Emerald and Black. No, I didn't play Black and White. Diamond. Diamond and...
Platinum?
No, I didn't play Platinum. I stopped at Diamond. Because I really like Diamond, but I just didn't have time.
See, I didn't like Diamond and Pearl that much.
They were cool.
Because
you could move all your Pokemon over from the Game Boy ones and get them.
Yeah.
I like that. It's really easy.
Well, it wasn't really easy. Because you could only transfer 6 of them at a time, and then you'd have to recapture them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really easy.
Yeah. Anyways.
You're just afraid.
Okay. So, next month, you're going to hear a lot more about us playing Pokemon X and Y.
Are you going to try and make me buy that game? Because I'll probably give in.
How Dustin's Mega Blaziken is going to die to my Mega Blastoise.
Mega Blaziken. Ugh. I want it. Anyway.
So, what else have I been playing?
Nothing, apparently.
I haven't had a lot of time to play games, and so Pokemon's been really nice. I mean, playing through it again, playing through another Pokemon game again, I'm seeing a lot of my previous frustrations come back up. Mainly that sometimes there's just too much battling.
That's why I stop playing most of the time, because I'm like, another battle?
So I have to play it in shorter spurts than I did when I was a kid, but I'm enjoying what they're doing more. I guess they can't really get out of that either, because they've really designed the game around the battling mechanic.
I can't believe you're still talking about Pokemon.
I really like Pokemon.
I can tell.
A lot.
You're not allowed to talk about Pokemon anymore.
I also played Pokemon Rumble U.
Right now? Oh, you did, yeah. You did play that.
I wouldn't recommend it. I got it because the figures are cool, but I'm not buying any more.
Until we go to the store and you buy them.
No, I went to the store and I saw them and I didn't buy them because they're random. If they weren't random, I probably would have bought them all. But they're random.
And you could randomly get one that's worth like $800.
Yeah, I could also randomly win the lottery, but I don't.
You don't play the lottery.
So, yeah, basically Pokemon Rumble U is a button masher. And that's it. Like, you literally could have a monkey play that game and probably win.
Literally a monkey. Next week, we're going to come back after having gotten a monkey and tested this.
Yeah, Dustin's going to try it out. So.
Ow! Jeez. Right for my
I was going to attack somebody and like mention someone who wasn't here, and then I was like, no, that's not nice. So.
Just attack me instead. Alright. See if that comes back and bites you.
Probably will. So yeah, I've been in a Pokemon mood lately.
Clearly.
I guess you could call me a Pokemaniac.
Pokemaniac? Yeah. I'd call you that. Okay. He walks around with a trainer belt, I swear to God.
I don't know.
He throws Pokeballs at people and tries to capture them. It's really funny.
I do have 10 badges.
He gets beat up a lot.
I have 10 badges.
It's okay. Are you done? Can I talk about what I played now?
Well, my favorite line in Pokemon White 2 is you're in Drifil City, and you go to one of these skyscrapers, and you're talking to them, and you're like, is your mom the receptionist at the Pokemon Center? Because you look a lot like her. And I'm like, that's really odd. So, yeah, you can talk about it
now. Okay, I'll talk now. What, are you just leaving? Okay. So, hi. I'm Dustin. And I've recently been playing Professor Layton and the Diabolical Box.
The worst Professor Layton.
It's not as good as the first one, I agree. It's,
but then the series just goes uphill from there.
It's a little slow to get started. Pretty much, so far, we're just kind of on this train.
It's like half the game.
And, I mean, I don't know. I haven't played very much. I mostly just caught up to where I was at, but it seems like another game in the Professor Layton series. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. I just kind of wanted to have something on my DS to play. You're being really loud.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to plug this in.
Why?
All of the viewers. Because the battery's almost dead.
Oh, yeah, that wouldn't work too well if we lost battery in the middle of a podcast.
Yeah, that's why I'm trying to.
Anyway, other than that, I haven't been playing a lot. I just played a little bit of Payday 2. here and there.
A little bit?
You know, just like maybe like 10 minutes or so.
Whatever Dustin used to, or told you guys last week about how he only played an hour and a half every night.
Oh, I doubled
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that average.
He's been playing an average of, I think, 3 hours a night.
I don't think it's 3 hours, but it's definitely in the 2 hour range.
No, the last couple of nights has been 3 hours.
Well, the last couple of nights we were stuck on trying to do a stealth mission that's really, really impossible. And it took us forever, and that happened. But, I mean, it's like 2 hours before bed, you know?
During my bedtime.
Well, yeah, because I have to do homework during my bedtime, so I have to push into your bedtime to get things done. What can I say about Payday 2? It's pretty good.
I might start playing.
I've almost convinced Blake to buy it,
because watching it's pretty awesome. Because, like, there's so much coordination there. I feel like the game sucks if you're not playing with the right people.
Oh, yeah. If you're playing with the AI or with dumb people, it's terrible.
Yeah, but if you're playing with the right people, like, it's just so cool because there's so much going on. And even the non-hero roles, I guess you would say, are still gratifying. Which is something I think is really hard design-wise to pull off usually. But I think it looks like they did that.
I'd say so. Although that mission that you were watching is kind of an outlier. Okay. Most of them you're all together doing stuff, but it's still lots of really frantic, good team communication work. It's just, I don't know, like, if you have a really good group of people to play with and you can actually coordinate efforts, like, it really feels awesome when you pull off a heist where you just, like, get out with millions of dollars worth of gold in bags. Like, it feels nice.
Unfortunately, Dustin crashed into a bank last week trying to do a heist in real life, so
that didn't happen.
We're, this is Dustin's farewell episode.
I'm calling from prison right now to be on the podcast. No, but Payday 2 is, it's really good. You should go buy it. It's pretty cheap.
Play with us.
It's like $30.
If you buy it, we will play with you. I will buy the game.
Don't we have
if
to,
someone
like,
on the show buys it, and I will play.
Aren't we supposed to, like, make people pay for that privilege? Like, isn't that what a lot of, like, isn't that what Mike and Jerry do to, like, make money? They're like, wasn't that one of their Kickstarter rewards? It's like, we will play a game with you.
Yeah, that was like their $1,000 one.
Yeah, see? We can make $1,000 from people instead of just being like, we'll play with you for free.
If you pay us $1,000, we will also play with you.
But if you just get it, we would probably
if you give us $1,000, we'll play with you in person.
I don't know if that's enough for, like, 2 plane tickets to somewhere.
$2,000.
There we go. That's a better
first
number.
Class. Well, or $1,000 and send the plane tickets first class.
That's yeah, that awesome. Works too. Okay. Whatever, you know, if you got miles to burn, whatever. Anyway, I think that's actually pretty much all I have been playing. I think so, yeah. I really need to get back to Resident Evil 6. I've been hiatusing that game for too long.
I don't even know what I'm hiatusing.
And now the new Amnesia's out, which is really making me want to play the old Amnesia.
Yeah, and I beat the first one of the first DLCs in Saints Row the Third. My Saints Row the Third playing has gone down a little bit because the DLC is just not as captivating as the game was.
It's not made for you.
Why?
It's made for other people.
Oh. Probably was, actually.
Yeah, you're not the target audience.
What's the target audience?
14-year-old boys.
Shit.
Anyway, I think I'm done with my
I have to go get some 14-year-old boys then.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
I'm joking.
Oh my gosh.
Speaking of 14-year-old boys, let's talk about The Last of Us.
You're what? Contributing to the internet culture.
I've just been reading way too much about ancient Greeks today.
And Penny Arcade.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm going to read Penny Arcade anymore.
Wow. Not going to PAX either?
I don't know. I have to think about it.
You don't know.
It's because
take a stand, Blake. Take a stand.
I don't know. I have to think about it. I like Alex Lifshitz.
Who's Alex Lifshitz, Blake?
He's an alumni from our major who was a producer at Microsoft, and I don't know what he does now. But Andy Phelps, the guy.
Who's Andy Phelps?
He's the guy who runs Magic, which is this initiative at RIT.
Jeez, what's RIT?
Rochester Institute of Technology. It's where we go to college if you want to find us.
Wow! That's good. That's safe. Now we're gonna have hordes of people showing up at RIT looking for those famous podcasters.
Please don't come to RIT.
No, they can come to RIT.
Please.
That would be cool.
Come to RIT, but don't find us.
No, they should come find us.
Please come to RIT and find us and alert security. That We are miscreants.
Yeah, that's a word.
So, and so anyways, he had a really good blog post. Maybe I'll link it here, because I thought it was also actually a really good blog post. Did you read it?
Yeah, I did, actually.
Did you like it?
I thought it was a really good blog post.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're linking that now, because yeah, we're linking we've talked that. About how good of a
post. Go RIT is. Alumni.
Oh, dying. Anyway.
Anyway.
We finished our segment, so now we can
talk about The Last of Us. So,
it's a PS3 exclusive.
About me and Dustin. We're the us in The Last of Us.
Are we? Because you don't look like Ellie.
You'd totally be Ellie.
I'm the Joel to your Ellie all day long.
I look more like Nolan North clone than you do.
I'm too short to be Nolan North.
Yeah. So anyways, The Last of Us. So, this is going to be very spoiler heavy, and from last episode, I want to reiterate the reason we're talking about all of these, this wide breadth of games from the last, year.
It's pretty narrow breadth, actually. There's only 3 games.
I meant from different, wide in terms of, they're kind of very
Two
different.
2 of them are third-person shooters. One of them, if it could be classified as anything, it would be very third-person
From this very narrow, I'm stupid... List
Brother
of games.
Word niche is in there.
Nietzsche, if you will.
Oh, God.
It's
a philosophy joke. Look it up.
We're going to be exploring...
Yeah, you're still laughing.
We're going to be exploring the proto-existentialist themes
Stop.
Of The Last of
Stop.
Us and looking at it from a perspective of beyond
Stop.
Good and evil.
Stop.
It's pretty good. So we really wanted to look at Bioshock Infinite... Not Bioshock... We were talking about Bioshock Infinite on 2 podcasts ago. The Walking Dead.
There you go.
Spec Ops The Line.
Got it.
And this game to discuss how... The Last of Us. To discuss how their gameplay and their narrative are currently pushing the bounds of games as art, I would say. And also games as a medium in general. I guess a medium of art, which is the same thing. But, nonetheless...
Are games art...
That will be a podcast 3 weeks from today. So.
3 weeks from today, another will die.
What's that from?
I don't even know. It just popped in my head. I feel like it is from something. I don't know what. Anyway, we're really bad at. Today, we're off topic.
Yeah, we've been. We were talking a lot off topic before the podcast, too. So
and I have work to do, so.
Yeah, and
chop.
I have to get to school as well to try something out.
That doesn't sound, suspicious
to,
at all.
I left the code that I've been currently working on at school, and I think I need it for what I need to do.
I noticed that we're not talking about The Last of Us.
The Last of Us. By Naughty Dog.
Correct.
So, why don't you start this conversation?
About The Last of Us?
Yeah.
So I recently had the pleasure of watching some grad students here at RIT play
What's
The Last of Us.
What's a grad student?
What's a grad student? A graduate student. A student who has graduated already
and
is still at RIT.
What type of grad students are they?
Masters of Game Design.
Okay. And development.
And development, yes. And they were playing The Last of Us as part of a class... event to play The Last of Us.
It's almost like, the way that I've been thinking about it, I didn't get to go, unfortunately, but the way I've been thinking about it is a critical reading of a game.
Yeah, that's a very good description. Other than that, and we did that, and I was there observing, watching people play The Last of Us for the first time, and it was very interesting to watch people that had never played the game before experience it for the first time, because it's hard to get that view when you yourself are in that moment. So it was kind of fun to step back and see how other people would interpret the game as it progressed for the first time. And, I don't know, one of the things that struck me was the incredible amount of silence from the audience. Because there was probably 25 people in that room. 25 adolescent males in a room with minimal supervision, I mean, it and a dark room, no less. So, comments could not necessarily be identified. So there, I thought there was going to be a lot of, you know, catcalling and making jokes and, like, I don't know, banter in general. And I was blown away by how captivated the audience was by the game, as including people that had already played the game and seen everything. I mean, I know that, like, there was a spoiler warning at the beginning to, like, let people know, don't spoil anything that's about to happen, like, you know, standard etiquette type rules, but still, minimal amounts of comments, minimal amounts of, like, any interruption, and a huge desire to continue playing the game without necessarily talking about it for too long, because it was so captivating, and people wanted to continue experiencing the game.
Even playing it alone, though, like, I mean, despite my breaks, when I would play the game, I would lose a couple hours in it, and I would be very immersed, and I'd always want to...
Oh, you played a game for a couple hours at a time? Wow, that's terrible.
Well, I would be like, it would be like, before, I would be like, I have a lot of work to do, I should only play this for an hour, and then I'd end up spending the whole day playing it. That's what I mean. And because it's just, it's such an immersive game, because the atmosphere and the characters and the feel of it all is just so, engrossing. I mean, the main thing that I think the main reason for that is you never lose a sense of the world, and you never feel as if it's, there's something wrong with the... You're never taken out of the magic circle, so to speak. That circle of illusion. You never... I mean, a lot of games, you'll have a bug, or you'll have something... I mean, in Mass Effect, I think it used to happen a lot, where a character would say something that wasn't quite right, or it would get... They'd get interrupted, or something would be wrong, but I never... And I mean, maybe I was just lucky, but with The Last of Us, that didn't happen. No. Everything was so fluid that I never had a chance to step back and, like, be like, oh, well, that was a little... Or maybe it wasn't existent, but I never even felt like something was silly or ridiculous. Everything at the entire time felt real. And I mean, in Bioshock Infinite, as we talked about 2 weeks ago, the first act of violence you do in the game, which is extremely, like, in your face,
literally,
you never feel that same, and I stepped back and I questioned that. In The Last of Us, I never questioned that first act of violence. It felt natural.
I guess it depends on when you determine the first act of violence, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's moments that you perform violence and moments when violence is performed for you. Which is interesting as well.
And I mean, one of the... yeah, so...
Because the first act of violence in the game is about 6 minutes in, like, when the next-door neighbor breaks through the glass and the main character at the time, who you're not playing as and you have no control over, shoots and kills that person. Which I thought was interesting, that the first act of violence is not committed by you, but rather by someone else who isn't... You have no control over. And they kind of, like, ease you into the game that way. Because then I think the second, like, major act of violence in the game, beyond your brother who's running with you shooting things along the way, which is kind of not super along the lines of the game plays, violence is when your partner, after, you know, the 20-year event, like, break, when she kills the gunrunner guy that you're chasing after...
And neither of you...
She kills him by shooting him in the head twice.
And neither Joel nor her flinch.
Yeah.
Almost said neither you nor her, which is funny.
Yeah, and neither of the... I mean, and so, like, the first time you actually are given agency to commit violent acts is actually an act of mercy. When there's a person who's trapped under some rubble in an area infested with the theoretical virus that's killing people and turning them into monsters... And you can either choose to shoot him or not. And I think that the idea is that a merciful player will shoot them and a non-merciful player will not, or whatever. But that's the first time you can actually, like, do something meaningful with your weapon. So it's very interesting how, like, to compare those two, that, you know, the entrance into violence is a lot smoother, I guess, in The Last of Us. Like, they kind of build you up to it, and they let you know, this is a violent place,
but,
this is
I mean,
a violent world.
You're also forgetting the other part, where you really see, before the act of violence by your partner, when you're at least this really sticks on my mind, when you're going to that location with her and she's leading you along and you're going through the city, there's a scene where you see a bunch of government officials beating up on a someone who lives there.
That's a really big scene.
And when you see that, all of a sudden you get this realization of what the world really is like and what the it seems like it's a police state, at least at that point in time. Like, oh, wow, they have a lot of control. We're undermining them. What has happened to America? But you also see the very violent thing, the violent way that things have gone. And I mean, I think that's set up from the beginning too. Dave, who was leading that playthrough, Dave Simpkins, who's a professor at RIT, he pointed out to me that you never see zombies until a lot later into the game. Even though the entire premise at the start is about zombies, they only show humans.
Them in the intro.
But they...
But they're not the clicker ones.
Well, no. You, most of the time, you're not looking at them. They're being described to you a lot, but most of the time, you're always looking ahead.
Really? Because yeah. I saw them within, 10 minutes of the game.
Well...
Because, the one busts through the door, and then you see them constantly on the way there.
But it's not focused on them. It's focused on the other people. At least...
One of them breaks through the door
of
your house.
Yeah, I mean, besides that, I mean, when you're running down, holding...
There's several huge moments when they're, okay. The zombies clearly... Like, when you're driving the truck up to the people who are, parked along the freeway, two of them run out, rip somebody out of a car, and eat them right in front of you.
Do you have to watch that, though?
You could look the other way, but the game leads you to look there. And you're not locked into looking there, but you, as a player, are, almost guaranteed to be looking there. Because that is the central focus of the action at that point. And then from that point, I mean, you get, you get attacked by one and have to do a quick time event to defend it. I agree with that point that you're kind of sheltered from it, but I would disagree that you don't
not
ever
exposed
see
to
them.
Okay. You are what okay.
But after that event, then there is a long period of time where you aren't exposed.
When you're in the beginning
of
the city.
So if that was the point, then I would agree there that once you take over at playing as Joel in the 20-year event later, you're only dealing with humans and humanity up until a much later point.
Yeah, my point is mainly they focus more on the people and the violence of the people and the very World War Z, the destruction of society, more so than the zombie enemy. Because the zombie enemy is mainly a catalyst towards showing a breakdown of society in general.
Oh, yeah. It's just like any other
good zombie story.
Or any disaster movie.
Yeah.
Be it an earthquake, a tornado, sharks,
Tornado sharks.
You heard about that, right? Sharknado?
Yeah.
The movie?
Yeah.
I want to watch it.
The one that's not real or something?
No, it's real.
Oh.
It actually is a thing.
Like, there was a tornado of sharks?
No. It was not real, but the movie is real.
Oh, yeah. I thought you meant, it's a real thing that happened.
Oh, God, no. I hope not.
A tornado of sharks?
Exactly. No, that'd be terrible.
So, anyways. I digress.
Okay. Digress.
I don't know what I'm digressing about. So.
You're talking about violence.
In video games. Well, we talked a lot about violence. I think the main thing that The Last of Us does extraordinarily well,
besides not having bugs, which is kind of amazing in of itself,
is the characterization. Every character feels like a real character. I think it is, in my mind, the best place I can point to in games for characterization.
Even better than... Jesus, why can't I remember the name right now?
Mass Effect?
No, that's a good one.
Walking Dead?
No, the one with the PS3 exclusive...
Uncharted?
No, it's a... Mystery.
L.A. Noir?
No.
That was in PS3.
Those people always say it's not a game.
Heavy Rain?
Yeah.
Yes.
Better than Heavy Rain.
I think these characters were better than Heavy Rain.
I think that they're pretty darn close. Because you really care about your characters in Heavy Rain.
You do, but I also think that in this game, the difference is that there's a lot more characters in the world. And
more characters.
I think there are more characters in the world. I mean, and I'm not talking just main. I mean, I think there's not a lot of... In Heavy Rain, one of the ways they got away with having such a focused game on the characters is they didn't have a lot of other characters. But, and I think the characters were well done, but I really don't think they were as well done as they were in The Last of Us. I think that you really, and I think a lot of it has to do with, I think the role playing is a lot, more intense in The Last of Us than it is in Heavy Rain.
What are you talking about?
I think that the role...
It's pretty similar. When you're in spoilers for Heavy Rain now, when you're playing as the woman and you're in that like sadistic dude's basement and he's about to like cut you up with saws,
yeah,
that was one of the most powerful sequences in a game for me. Like, I was sweating because that was so much work. Like, trying to not die in that moment, that was terrifying to me.
But I mean,
I never felt that in The Last of Us. I felt a lot of good emotion and I was very tied to my characters, but I never felt that.
I felt that a lot when I was hiding from the different people, or even when Ellie was being held down by the sadistic character in The Last of Us.
Which time?
The one that was...
When you're fighting him as a boss?
Yes.
That was a cool... I liked that.
I felt...
It was a different
kind of... I also, like... I could relate with Joel... And I also felt like I was, I also always was sweating bullets a lot of times for most of the encounters.
That's interesting.
Which might
be... I wonder why that is.
Which might be because I took them more as stealth segments, but I always had a fear of the other people. I never felt like I was in a comfortable situation to beat them.
I agree with the lack of comfort, but I mean...
So that's why...
I feel like you had a lot of agency in this game, which helped me feel more powerful. Whereas in... I mean, I don't think that was necessarily to its detriment, but the fact that you have agency and you, like, you can fight back, as it were, I never... Like, that, to me, makes me feel less... Not necessarily less attached, but, like, I felt less nervous about things because I knew that I had agency to handle my problems. Which, whereas in Heavy Rain, there were more moments where I enjoyed role playing helplessness because that's, you know, a different emotion. But I never felt that in The Last of Us that I can think of, where I felt helpless.
I never,
because the game always empowered you.
I think in the beginning there's a point where you feel
in helpless. The very very beginning, yes, because you're running for your life.
If I remember correctly, and I haven't played the beginning in a while, because I played the beginning when it came out, isn't there a point where you don't have weapons yet? Or do you always have weapons?
As Joel, after the 20 years, you always have weapons. Okay. As soon as you... There is a quick point when you don't, but you're just walking, and you're only walking to get to the sewer area, and then you get your backpack,
which is
your
first fire iron. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I will agree that in Heavy Rain, I think this has a lot to do though with what we were talking about the other day, where I'm not sure actually if Heavy Rain does. I mean, when I or Ethan, whatever, had to cut the finger off,
right?
That was cringeworthy.
Yep.
And
I love that scene.
I'm not sure The Last of Us did any worse of a job.
I think it was worse.
Okay.
I would say they're on almost equal ground.
I don't think The Last of Us tried to have as many shock scenes. It's like in
that's
the,
what you call
like, shock. It's like in The Walking Dead spoiler where you have the choice to cut off your arm.
That was pretty shocking.
That was also pretty immersive.
I think shock can be very immersive because it puts you, the fact that you're feeling like good shock and not like jump scare shock is something that's hard to capture, which is why it's so memorable in games, like, where you actually are so invested in a character you're role-playing as on the screen of a television, and you actually cringe because of something that you aren't actually having happen to you, that's amazing. Anytime that happens, in my opinion.
Which we'll probably feel in October when Beyond Two Souls
comes out. That game is going to be awesome.
So, I have a feeling this discussion is going to come back.
I hope it does. I think it's great.
We've been talking a lot lately about role-playing in
I think it's great games. That we can debate about to what level of, like, realism and attachment to your characters do you have. As yeah, opposed to, like, being like, this is clearly better than this.
Yeah.
Even Spec Ops does a good job with, like, connecting you to your squad mates. Like, there aren't a lot of characters, but you do become, through the banter and, like, the actions of your characters, like, because in that game you lose both of your companions, and, I don't know, I thought it was powerful both times they died. Like, especially when, the machine gunner, why can't I remember his name?
I don't remember his name either.
the not Lugo. Because I remember Lugo's name for some reason, but I don't remember the other guy. When he dies, because, like, when you, you and him are the only two left, I think, and Lugo's dead at that point, and, you're surrounded by these people from the area you're in. Like, they're just, they're kind of, like, I don't know, they don't seem too malicious, but they're all starting to become rather malicious and, like, picking up rocks and weapons and items and stuff, like, around you. And, you're trying to do something. I forget what the main character is trying to do, but he, the machine gunner, is like, holding the crowd back.
Oh, that scene.
That scene. And then they kill him.
And, well, like, you, what they force you to do there is they...
Oh, no, he doesn't die. It's Lugo that's dead. That's right. Right?
Well, they force you to shoot at the crowd.
No, you don't have to. You can walk through them.
Yeah.
Or you can shoot in the air, and they'll disperse.
Yeah. I shot the crowd.
You just lost one of your companions, and, like, you feel this extreme rage. And you're just like, I want all of these people dead. I can't believe what they just did. And you, like, you don't have to mow them down, but, I mean, I can say I shot them as well. I was very upset at that time. I was just like, get out of my way.
I think I was so emotionally invested at that point that I didn't feel like there was another solution. Which I think is something they were trying to get at. I think that's what a lot of these games... maybe not as much The Last of Us, because The Last of Us doesn't present you with choice that often.
No, it's more about pure survival instincts, yeah. Which is interesting.
The Walking Dead game and Spec Ops really, at times, get at... You had this choice, but you were so caught up in the moment or whatever that you made the wrong choice.
Well,
You made a choice.
And now you have to live with the consequences of that, which is really powerful.
Going back to the role-playing thing, I think the main difference with Spec Ops, though, is that I never felt as crazy as Walker was.
And, I think that's a hard thing to role-play,
and,
though.
Yeah, it is. And I think... By the end of the... And I think they did a good job, but after that twist, where you find out that he's... that he's having PTSD, I feel a lot more detached from that character. Because I can think about it as, I shot these people, and I was trying to free the hostages, and I went on this journey. But then the moment that it gets to the point of the final acts, and when you find that out, it's my choice was, I chose for Walker to let himself die. I don't think about it as I died.
I think that's what they wanted. I actually think the designers wanted at that point for you to step back and be like, okay, now you know this, but think of all the things. Like, detach yourself from the character now. It's not about you being Walker. It's about you being the player. I think that was really gutsy of them to, like, do. But I remember hearing or reading about, like, them talking about deciding to make that a pivotal thing and, like, forcing you to consider yourself as the player outside of yourself role-playing. And I think that was a very dangerous thing for them, but if you get it and, like, you think about it and you're like, oh, wait a second, they want to talk to me as the player, not me as Walker. Oh, wow. Okay, now there's something here a bit more substantial. I think that was one of the most powerful parts of that game was that at points you can tell that they were trying to talk to the player and say, hey, this is this is kind of what we're trying to get you to think about. And I thought that was cool.
And bringing it back to The Last of Us, they also... they didn't necessarily bring it back to the player, but this entire idea of trying to make these points at home... The Last of Us did something very interesting narratively, which is...
There's a lot of things interesting narratively.
Well, first of all, one of the main interesting things narratively is that I never felt like you were... You were never the hero. You were at most an anti-hero, if that. And you never feel like... At the moment in which you feel like you might be some sort of savior figure, they take that away from you, and you have to essentially, Joel out of self, this is the end, Joel out of self-interest, because he doesn't know how he could live without her, or lose another daughter, really.
Let's talk about Ellie. Because in that, you need to set this up better.
Ellie.
In the end of the game, spoiler, really big spoiler, like, ruins the game if you don't know that this
honestly
happens.
Ruins the game.
In the end of the game, you finally, you as Joel and Ellie both reach this research center where you've known that you've been trying to take Ellie there the whole game, so it's like, you know that you're in the end. You're like, okay, I've got the girl, I'm gonna bring her to the place, and then... You know that they're going to try and do tests on her because she is somehow immune to the virus. And they're going to try and create a vaccine or some way to prevent the virus from being a problem. You know, it would literally change the face of the world. It would allow people to come back and, like, defeat this thing once and for all. And...
It gives hope back to humanity.
Yeah, and you as the player, I feel, at least when I played it, felt like, wow, I'm doing the right thing, like, I'm gonna give her up for what I need to do, like, I've got this, like, no problem.
And from an objective, there's a very interesting theme in Star Trek,
which produces
a dichotomy between the idea of doing what is right and... kind of what you end up doing from a standpoint of an emotional perspective, where the Vulcans are the quintessence of logic, and at least in, I think, Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek's mind, what is always logically the right thing to do, morally correct, versus Kirk, a human, who... is often wrapped up in his emotional duty. And so, and I think it's Star Trek... Spock dies in Star Trek 2. And in Star Trek 3, I think it's that one, Kirk essentially saves Spock at the risk of an entire planet getting destroyed. And Spock is like, Kirk, why did you do that? That was... obviously not the logical, correct thing to do, but Kirk says, well, sometimes it's not about the logic. It's what I felt like I should do. And so, going back to The Last of Us, that's really the standpoint Joel's at, where from what I would say is the logical, non-emotional... And
the point that Ellie wishes as well.
And the point Ellie wishes.
Ellie knows that she is going to be... experimented on and has a possibility of dying in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And Joel was not necessarily as aware of that, and he's a lot more, like, apprehensive, but he seems willing to go through with it because of, that is, as you were saying, the logical choice. And she is 100% for it. Like, she is like, I don't care, I survived this long, I need to do this.
And that is really revealed after the fact, too. Where... I mean, what happens is Joel ends up saving her, and...
You really do a bad job of telling the story, like, jeez.
I'm not trying to tell the story as much as I am trying to...
If people don't know, though. They're gonna wanna, like... they wanna know.
So anyways, you can fill in the gaps after I'm done.
Okay, so Joel goes through the... After Joel wakes up from, like, sleeping and being passed out, because he was really tired from taking her there, he is separated from her, and, like... He's told by, you know, the people that work there, like, you know, Ellie's in treatment now, we'll see what happens, like, we're just gonna have to wait and see. And he's just like, oh, what? I don't think that's okay. And grabs his weapons in his backpack and rampages angrily through the entire facility, kills almost every single support staff member in the entire building, kills the doctors that are about to begin the procedure.
I only killed one of the doctors.
Yeah, you only have to kill one. But you do have to kill that one. You can't not kill
him. I was trying not to.
Because I tried not to as well. Picks her up in an unconscious state, takes her out of the facility, and puts her in the car that they have. I forget how they got the car. They have a car.
It's a Firefly car.
That's it, yep. And drives her away from the facility. Okay, I caught it up now. So they know that that's how Ellie gets back to being
safe. At which point Ellie is safe, and she basically, well, I'll get to that point in a second, but, so Joel, at least the interpretation on what his character is he has such emotional investment in Ellie, he cannot live, and even though it's not the logical thing, and he knows it's not the logical thing, he needs her, and so he does what he, you can understand his point of view, he's doing what he feels he should do, not what he thinks is necessarily the right thing to do. And I think that's just a really powerful character move, because it's a very deep character. I mean, it's not a... I mean, you could almost say... You are, I guess, in somewhat of an antagonistic role at that point, but...
Well, yeah, because, I mean, in terms of humanity's survival, you should just let her go. Like, she's okay with it. Like, everything is perfectly set up for it to go down, except for you. Which is really interesting, because usually it's like, okay, then we just know that that's what we're going to do, because everything else is pointing to it, like, everything else is saying this is the correct path. And usually your character would be like, okay, I understand this, the greater good is what is worth protecting, I'm going to, you know, allow this. But Joel doesn't. He's a flawed character. He allows his own emotion to overcome everything else that's being told to you as the player and to him as the character that should be happening.
The good of the many does not always outweigh the good of the few, is Joel's perspective.
And he's, like, and it's so powerful because he spent the whole game, like, so much of the game resenting what he was doing. Like,
but
he wanted to get rid of
it. But the entire journey was to get to that point. And so what he ends up doing, I'll try to do this right.
Okay.
They're driving away, they're in the back of the car, and she's kind of down, and so he tells her that the Firefly had other people who had... The Firefly's the organization, by the way, that is throughout the game, but at the end they're the people who are really trying to research the vaccination, and he says that the Firefly had other candidates, and he didn't want her to die because of it, because they have plenty of other candidates, and she acts like she doesn't fully believe that, and so eventually the car breaks down, and they stop, and they get out, and Joel's like, all right, come on, and the place we're going is right over that ridge, and it's the place you had been earlier, it's where your brother has basically set up camp, and so you and Ellie are going, and Ellie seems a bit down, and right at the top of the hill, you see the facility, and Ellie's like, Joel, you got to promise me that you're telling me the truth about it all. And Joel, like, looks at her, and she's like, you have to look me straight in the eyes and tell me you're telling the truth. And Joel turns to her and says, I'm telling the truth.
Yep.
And then that's how the game ends. And it is fantastic. And it really... it's not even... Joel was totally selfish. Totally flawed. And yet...
It's a reversal on the entire game.
And the story... If you think about it, the world doesn't change. Nope. The world they are in does not change. There's less people because of Joel, but...
And less research being done.
Yeah, and less
overall,
research
I
being
mean,
done.
There's no progress made towards anything.
No. It ends up being just about living.
Yeah, it is. And I love it because it was like a huge reversal of what this entire thing had been leading up to. Because, I mean, throughout the game, you start off playing as Joel, who is resentful about having to take care of Ellie. And then, like, throughout the game, the whole game is about them growing to learn to trust each other as companions and survivors in this world. And then in the final moments of the game, Joel takes the trust you just spent 16 hours building up and just snaps it. Like, just... It's like, it's just the most powerful thing, because you've spent the whole game building up a bond of trust between two people, and then Joel breaks that trust because of his own selfish desires. Not because that's what she wanted, and not to protect her. It is to protect her, and to an extent, to what he's done, but even that is selfish. He's protecting her from him, not from what she wanted, because what she wanted, she had already decided. He is lying to her to protect himself.
And it's a very... It's a very effective ending, though.
Amazing. Just couldn't believe it.
And the greatest part about it, because Dave was telling me about this, they playtested that ending. And it playtested really poorly.
Really?
And it did not get good results.
Wow.
But they decided to keep it in there. Ah. Because they felt that that's how it should end. And
I think it was great. It's not the happy ending.
No.
It sucks as an ending.
Yeah.
Like, you play that, and you're like, what?
And then the credits roll.
You almost can't play the game for a while because you're so upset with Joel. Like, I was really like, I can't believe Joel just did that. I don't even know if I would want to talk to him again. I don't know if I want to play another game as Joel because he is such a terrible person. But you don't blame him.
But you never, you don't blame him, and you always understand his position.
That is the support. You never,
and I think that's the really important part. You never lose a sense of his humanity.
No, because you think about it, and you're like, well, I mean, I might do the same thing. Like, it seems possible. You like to think that you wouldn't do that, but I mean, in your mind and in your heart's heart, you know that, like, wow, would I do something different if I knew everything that I know about Joel's life? I don't know, but. Oh, such a non-traditional ending. I mean, and it doesn't require a sequel. That's the best part. It could have a really great one.
Even though they are having single-player DLC.
I don't know what that's going to be. Hopefully it's good.
I couldn't even bring myself to play the multiplayer in that game just because of the story.
I couldn't either. I was like, I don't even want to play the
single
player.
It's such a, like... The multiplayer has to feel so... I don't know. Such a testament to... Like, that world that...
I've heard people say it's good.
Yeah, but, like, I don't know. I don't know if I'd be able to remove myself from the world enough to be able to play that multiplayer, because...
Where it's all about fighting other people.
Yeah. In a very... I don't know. Ironic sense. Anyways. Yeah. So, I think overall, that's just The Last of Us, and The Last of Us, and Last of Us's... The Last of Us I... The ending was just amazing, and the entire journey through the game was amazing, and I think it really shows where games can go, and where I hope games are headed, because The Last of Us really is one of the strongest examples of games as an art I can think of, because that ending was a very deep ending.
Non-traditional.
And that...
To the core.
And I would also argue that because... And we'll get into this in another episode, I'm sure, but because of the fact that it's a game, you feel that ending more so than you feel it with a book, I think. Because,
or a movie.
Or a movie. Sure. Because you are so involved in the mind and the life of Joel that...
Because you've been Joel.
You've been him.
For a while.
And the other thing is you've been Ellie, so it hurts even worse.
Oh, yeah, because you do get to play as Ellie for certain points. And you also played as Joel's daughter
yeah.
in the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, you've really seen the breadth of Joel's character, and you don't see it coming, really. You really don't see that as the ending of the game. You really never saw it coming.
So thank you for joining us.
You want to thank our sponsor?
Thanks for Dunham Gaming for, we're going to be hosted on them soon. Pretty soon, I think.
Next week is going to be something new.
We're probably going to be a little more lighthearted with our topics next week, because we've been going pretty heavy lately.
Will we? We should probably avoid most of the things we've said we would do as podcasts then.
Yeah, we're probably... I don't know what we're talking about.
I'll find something at Fig to talk about.
Oh, yeah, we might talk about... That would be a really good podcast. Even though we could talk more about
the indie scene.
The indie scene. We might do that because Dustin is going on a field trip to Boston Fig this weekend.
Festival of Indie Games.
In Boston, at MIT, actually. So
it's going to be fun.
Yeah. So thanks for listening. And play The Last of Us if you haven't.
Seriously. Like, you should be playing it.
Yeah.
I know people that are buying PS3s to play this game. Mm-hmm. So, like, seriously. End the console generation rate. Buy The Last of Us.
And then Grand Theft Auto 5.
Yep.
Bye.